Welcome to the Baptist Joint Committee Podcast. In this episode, Frank Lambert discusses the secular and sacred alliance in the fight for religious liberty. This is his second presentation for the 2012 Walter B. and K.W. Sheridan Lectures on Religious Liberty and Separation of Church and State. Dr. Lambert is a professor at Purdue University. He gave this lecture on the campus of Mercer University in Macon, Georgia.
And let me just sort of frame what we're doing this week. There are three lectures, and I'm looking at the three claims made by a group of historians, very conservative historians, ultra-conservative, I would say, who are styled in the popular press as, quote, evangelical historians. And their argument runs this way. The first claim is America was founded as a Christian nation, explicitly as a Christian nation, for Christian purposes, based on Christian principles. Secondly, that view of American history has been undermined by secularist, modern-day secularist, liberals, and all other evil people. And that's the one we're going to talk about this afternoon. And then tomorrow in chapel, right, is the last one, and that is on the separation of church and state. These historians that I referred to deny that there was ever intention for a separation of church and state. They base that on the fact that phrase is not in the Constitution. I hope we, if not putting a dent in that, maybe even blew a hole in it. It's an argument from silence that's rather silly, quite frankly. So this afternoon, I would like to come to talk about the sacred and the secular. It seems to me that we're in a time in our society that is polarized in many different ways, and certainly it's polarized over the place of religion in American public life. On the one hand, there are the people from the far religious right who think that everything ought to be phrased in religious language. They deny any kind of secular influence, and they blame secularists for undermining religion and religious freedom. I'll say more about that in a moment. On the other hand, are secularists who want to deny that religion has played an important part in American history, which is equally ridiculous and distorted. Without question, religion has and does play an extremely important role in American history, as does secular influences. And I noted this morning, and I will say this, I got this from historian George Marsden. Great historian. You know, obviously, my name just rolls right off my tongue there. But he is a fine historian and a real gentleman to boot. I steal this from him, and I might say that historians, or at least this one, is really unoriginal. I seldom ever have original ideas, so everything comes from somebody else, and this comes from George Marsden, who notes that from the beginning, from the founding of America, even in the colonial period, that America is deeply sacred and deeply secular. And you don't understand America until you understand both of those. Sometimes their intention. Sometimes their intention within individuals. Sometimes there's much more cooperation. Unfortunately, what is happening today, it seems to be in this polarizing atmosphere, that we're taking a view of either or history. And history doesn't work that way. History doesn't work that way. It is both and. And I hope that in our discussion this afternoon, we can talk about the importance of both sacred influences and secular influences. Let me just problematize this a bit further. Foreigners are absolutely mystified by American culture. On the one hand, they see Americans as totally secular, the most secular people on the face of the earth, consumed with the almighty dollar. We are the capitalist capitalist. One's worth, literally, is defined by capital, by net worth. And so foreigners look at us and say, gee, that is a secular society. On the other hand, especially every 4 years, they look at our presidential elections. They listen to all the religious rhetoric, good and bad and indifferent, and they can't understand it. I mean, here are people who are so religious, they wear their religion on their shirt sleeves. I had an interview, Risar was interviewed by Veja, which is a Brazilian newsweek, if you will. And the reporter was asking me to explain the place of religion in this year's GOP campaign. I started to tell her good luck and hang up, but I tried to talk for 45 minutes, and I'm not so sure that she was enlightened at all. But she was mystified. She said, I really don't get it. The world sees you as these people who are consumed with money and consumed with spreading capitalism around the world. And on the other hand, we're a republic down here. We don't talk about religion all the time. Religion isn't an important part of a presidential campaign's rhetoric. So this question of secular and sacred is one that has appeal or at least interest both at home and abroad. Let me offer a couple definitions, working definitions, and then later on I'll give you John Cotton, the Puritan minister, John Cotton's take on sacred and secular. And I might hasten to say that many times the line between what's sacred and what is secular is blurred and sometimes shifts. I would characterize it, if we were using PowerPoint here, which I try not to use at every point I can, but if I were, there would be two concentric circles, one labeled sacred, one secular, and there would be a fair amount of overlap in there. And perhaps over time, that overlap period would either contract or expand. By secular, I'm talking about things of this age, things of the world, if you will, if you want to put it in spiritual terms, versus things of eternity or of the world to come. So sacred is holy, it's set aside, it has to do with God, sacred things of this earth. Certainly Jesus understood the difference between sacred and secular and was very much concerned about boundaries. I mean, for example, when he walked into the temple and drove out the money lenders or money changers or whoever they were, the capitalists who were in there trying to make a buck before services began, he was not saying, I am opposed to money changing. He didn't say, I'm opposed to money lending. I'm opposed to merchants or capitalism or any of that. But he was saying, this isn't the place, this isn't the time. And he was concerned about the boundaries between the two. Now, it seems to me that the argument that the religious right makes that religion is under attack, and it's under attack from secularists, is a misplaced argument. First of all, if you look at any poll, the last one I saw, 91% of Americans believe in God. Where are the atheists? Where are all of these people that despise religion? There may be some, but they're not there in large numbers. And the other piece of it is, the people who are attacking the religious right, for the most part, it's the religious left, or it's believers, people who say they don't represent my view of Christianity. And so it seems to me that this whole notion that religion is under attack is misplaced. And quite frankly, if you attack particular views that are harmful, that lead in the wrong direction, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with pointing out those things? It seems to me when when you have religious views that that trample on basic justice, on the rights of human beings, that think that poverty is 100% the fault of the impoverished, who never find a war that they don't like, that ought to be called out. That ought to be talked about. Well, I don't know how this sense of crisis that the religious right says that we're in, a crisis of faith or whatever, I don't know how that got created, but I do know, as a historian, that this isn't the first time that there has been this sense that we have lost our way. We started out as one people, and we have lost our way. Let me mention three examples. Look at all the students. It happens every time. If you say three, you've already written down 1, 2, 3, right? Good, good. You know, you're doing it right. Number one, 1827 was a controversy over the deliverance of the Sunday mails, of delivering mail on Sunday. Congress had passed, under great pressure from merchants, had passed a law in 1810 that post offices would remain open on Sunday. And the reason is, I mean, merchants said, look, we need our sales flyers to go out. We need our invoices to go out. We need money to come in. That's what commerce is about. So Congress passed that law. Well, there was a hue and cry, primarily from religious leaders. And one leader, a guy by the name of Ezra Stiles Ely, great name. And students, again, if you ever have a male child, you might want to consider naming him Ezra Stiles Ely. He was a Presbyterian minister, and he decided that what we need is a Christian political party. That we can't have a secular society making these kinds of decisions, and we need a Christian party led by Christian men that would make sure that only Christians are elected to highest office and would then operate in only Christian ways, and we would never have this kind of problem again. I'm proud to say that Baptists led the way, as did a lot of other people, in opposing that, in opposing what they thought was an interference in civil proceedings, and said, no, we're opposed to this exclusive notion of a Christian party. We see it as divisive. Again, it's putting people of faith against people, against these merchants. And, of course, those aren't exclusive. I mean, many merchants were people of faith as well. The second instance, 1864, another time of crisis, obviously. This is in the midst of the Civil War. There was a group called the National Reform Association, made up of primarily Presbyterian ministers, but also some lay people, and they were very concerned about what had happened to the nation. Here we are split apart. That more perfect union was in disarray. Why? Well, they said it was because the country had turned its back on God, on religion, and we must do something about that. And what they wanted to do was to put forth a constitutional amendment. It's called the Christian Amendment, or sometimes the Sovereignty of God Amendment. As we talked about this morning, in the preamble to the United States Constitution, there's no mention of God. There's no mention of the sovereignty of God, and that was very upsetting to some people who expected that. So here was a movement in 1864 that said, let's correct that, let's have the constitutional amendment. Again, Baptists and others, in the name of religious freedom, and then concerned about the government being involved in defining what is Christian, opposed it. It did not pass. And then finally, 1955, another crisis. It's the Cold War. And that was when Congress, with full endorsement by President Eisenhower, changed the motto. The motto was a product of the Enlightenment, and we'll talk about the Enlightenment in a moment. But the Enlightenment, I mean, their motto was "E pluribus unum," out of many, one. And Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and others had put that together. And so here we are in the middle of the Red Scare. We're in the middle of the Cold War. It's godless communism against God-fearing Americans, and we need to reflect that in our motto. And so the motto was changed in "God We Trust." Now, I'm not saying we should or shouldn't have done that, but I am saying that took place in a time of crisis. That took place when people were fearful, not when they were confident. Well, as much as the people of faith accuse secularists of all that's wrong about America, it goes the other way as well. I had a bit of a tiffed in print with the late Christopher Hitchens, fine historian, very provocative historian. His last work before he died really made the argument that pretty much anything bad that has happened in history happened because of religion. Well, that's a bit deterministic. That's a bit reductionistic. He had argued, I'd done a book on Barbary Wars, and he accused me of being a reductionist in making an argument that it was all about, or primarily about, commerce. And he said, oh no, it's all about religion. All problems are all about religion. So, you know, this door swings both ways on sacred and secular. Well, let's get to something to wake up our students a bit. And that's 1752, and Benjamin Franklin goes flying his kite. Now, Franklin was self-educated, an autodidact, as we call it. And by the way, students over there, if you want to learn how to be a really good writer, follow the practice of Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin was in London. He picked up essays from the Spectator, and he copied them, word for word. He'd go back to his room, he'd copy them over and over. Then he would try to produce them without looking at the text. And he paid attention to form. What's in an essay? What's the structure of an essay? Then he started writing original essays, and then he got rich. So think about that. Benjamin Franklin was a person that was curious about the world about him. He, Thomas Jefferson, many others at the time who were products of the Enlightenment, and I will get around to defining that in a moment, believed that, first of all, they believed in God. They believed that God created everything. They believed in a natural order. They believed that it was an orderly universe that operated according to God's laws, natural laws, and they wanted to understand those. As a matter of fact, they believed that nature was revelation. Scripture's revelation, but so is nature. And if you read nature, you read the hand of God at work. Well, on the other hand, Franklin believed that lightning, which was a scourge in the 18th century, not only in the colonies, but in Europe. I mean, if there's a lightning strike, and it hits a building in Boston, this happened to Boston several times, the place is burned down. If there's a wind, it just burns to the ground. London had some terrible fires, swept through all of London. So lightning was a real scourge. Now, the Puritans believed that lightning was a divine instrument. It was supernatural. When lightning occurred, God was sending a message. And what they would do, if Boston burned, a part of it burned, the next day they would have a day of fasting, a day of prayer, and they would look to themselves, what have we done? What have we done that God is punishing us with lightning? Well, Franklin didn't see it that way. He said it's electricity. It's a natural phenomenon. And to demonstrate that, he flew his kite. Actually, I'm not going to go into the details of how to make the kite. It's pretty simple, but if you do that, you could get electrocuted. In fact, one poor guy in Holland tried to replicate Franklin's experiment. The good news is his kite was struck by lightning. The bad news is he was too, and he died. He didn't read that part of Franklin's experiment that said, make sure you're standing inside the door of a building on dry ground. He missed that part. But from his experiment, Franklin concluded that lightning is a natural phenomenon. It's electricity. And as electricity, it has a current, it has a flow. It can be controlled. It can be grounded. From that, he came up with a very simple, but one of the epic inventions, the lightning rod. Put it on buildings, run a ground into the ground. Lightning hits the rod, the tallest part of the building, and it goes harmlessly in the ground. John Adams, in 1752, was a student at Harvard. And he, in his diary, talks about the reaction to Franklin's lightning rods. And it's fascinating. And it really highlights this tension between sacred and secular. Many of the people saw Franklin's invention as wonderful. And they immediately put lightning rods up all over town. Some ministers did. Others didn't. Others said, you're toying with God's instrument. You are interfering with God's work. Therefore, we don't want anything to do with it. And they didn't put it up. We see some of that today, the reluctance to embrace science, and you know that somehow science, somehow the understanding that comes from knowing nature is antithetical to God or antithetical to religion. I have a hard time seeing that. At the time, 1752, Harvard had two major chairs. There was a chair of theology and a chair of natural philosophy. And each saw the world differently. Each had different emphases, the theology focusing on the supernatural and the natural philosophy on the secular. The religious right, or these historians that we talked about this morning, want nothing to do with the Enlightenment, with reason, with science. They want to see American history conceived solely as a sacred event. So I briefly want to rush ahead to 1776 before I come back into the middle of the 18th century. And I want to go to the preamble of the Constitution. That sets forth the purposes of this new government, this new republic. And bear in mind this notion that we just heard. The United States was conceived as a sacred state, a Christian state. Well, let me give you, and this will be familiar to most of you. If it isn't, nod your head that it is, students. In the preamble, we the people of the United States, in order what? Form a more perfect union. That's number one. And why is it number one? It's the immediate need that the delegates saw. Now, we like to lionize these delegates. They see, you know, they were more concerned about us in 2012 than they were themselves. Baloney. They had big problems, and they were trying to solve the problems. The Constitution that they were under, the Articles of Confederation, didn't work. Absolutely didn't work. The country was bankrupt. The country was weak. It was beset on all sides by more powerful foes, and there's no army, there's no navy, there's no money to provide for those. So in order to form a more perfect union, that begins. The second one, establish justice. That means whatever we do in putting together a republic, we've got to have equal treatment, fair treatment of the people and the states under law. It's going to be the rule of law. Third, let me add before I leave equal justice, this really was touchy at the Constitutional Convention, quite frankly, because of the sectional split over slavery, and it was there then. Madison said, biggest split in the Constitutional Convention was not large state, small state. Planters in the South, slave-owning planters in the South, and merchants in the North. Third one, ensure domestic tranquility. Why do you think they put that one in? Shays' Rebellion. Daniel Shays, a veteran of the American Revolution, is leading, guess what? He is leading a tax revolt in western Pennsylvania, Massachusetts. And, you know, he and some of his farmers go to tax collectors who come out of Boston, and they take pitchforks and put them at their necks and say, I don't think you want to sign that document taking away my neighbor's land. And guess who the lieutenant governor was back in Boston saying, we can't have this kind of tax protest? Samuel Adams. Irony all over the place. He who led Boston Tea Party and what have you. The next one, promote the general welfare. That's one of those ambiguous features of the Constitution. What does it mean? Promote general welfare. In 1776, it meant at least to provide infrastructure, roads, communication, vehicles, and what have you, and education, public education. And secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. The whole purpose of putting together a much stronger government, and the Constitution was much stronger than what had existed before. It was very powerful. The purpose of it was to safeguard liberty. I mean, the Declaration of Independence talks about natural rights that people have. Well, that's all well and good, but if you don't have a strong enough government to protect those natural rights, it's an empty promise. So I really have difficulty accepting the argument that the United States Constitution is a prime example of a Calvinist document creating a religious society. From the very beginning of American settlement, or that is European settlement of America, there were twin objectives. I mean, if you look at this morning, we talked about Massachusetts Bay Colony as a holy commonwealth, a Christian commonwealth. But in that commonwealth, there was a dual pursuit, and it was a pursuit of piety and profits. Piety and profits. And we talked about how those clashed in the form of the merchant Robert Cain. So we have both of these from the very beginning. Now, John Cotton, who was a leading Puritan divine, wrote a sermon called A Discourse About Civil Government in a New Plantation Whose Design is Religion. So what should civil government look like in a holy commonwealth? Now, let me hasten to say that that Cotton does a nice job defining that, but he also was one of the leading offenders in violating what he had written about separating church and state. Let me just read a bit about from this sermon. He began his analysis of what a government should, how a government should be constituted in the Holy Commonwealth by asserting that both church and state have the same last, as he, that's his word, last or ultimate end, and that is the glory of God. By that statement, he meant that all human endeavor falls under the ultimate rule of God and serves divine purpose. And guess what? So did Jefferson. So did Adams. So did Franklin. I mean, when Jefferson talks about in the Declaration of Independence, natural rights, those come from God. So there's this overarching rule of God. So everything else, devising civil constitutions and what have you, take place beneath that. So for those secularists who say that Jefferson and all of these guys were only concerned about secular matters, not true. So while both church and state serve this ultimate end of the glory of God, Cotton continued to say they differ in their next ends, their more immediate ends. That is, in their more immediate operations and goals. The purpose of civil order, and administrations is the preservation of human society in outward honor, justice, and peace, while that of church order and administrations is the conversion, edification, and salvation of souls, pardon of sin, power against sin, peace with God, etc. And it's this understanding that led almost every single colony, and even the states, to put in their constitutions a clause that said ministers could not hold office in civil government. And it wasn't because they didn't think that they would be good officials. It's because they thought what they were doing was too important. What they were doing in their sacred administrations, too important to be doing things in government. Leave that to other people. At the end of his sermon, he made a comment that I think we should heed. He warned that two extremes must be avoided in defining and maintaining a just harmony between these two different orders and administration. Number one, they should not be confounded. They should not be confounded, either by giving the spiritual power, which is proper to the church, into the hand of the civil magistrate, or, as Erastus would have done, a matter of excommunication. And two, by giving civil power to church officers who are called to attend only to spiritual matters and the things of God and therefore may not be distracted from them by secular entanglements. I know some ministers today who didn't get that part about the secular entanglements, and they're up to their eyeballs in secular entanglements. I don't think you can really understand what's happening today with the tension between secular and sacred without understanding the two most transformative intellectual currents that flowed through America in the 18th century. I don't think you can understand the tension between science and faith without understanding this. And I'm talking about the Great Awakening, which was a religious revival, and I'm talking about Enlightenment. Now, people used to talk about the Enlightenment, but the fact of the matter is Enlightenment was expressed many different ways in many different countries. There's a Scottish Enlightenment, a French Enlightenment, an English Enlightenment, American Enlightenment. All of them subscribed to certain principles that we will talk about, but they had local differences. Before I talk about each one separately, let me make a comment about what they shared in common, about what they had in common. If you want to understand why America is so consumed with the individual and individual freedom, you can't go to a better place than to look at both the Awakening and the Enlightenment. Now, the Awakening, both of them, by the way, challenged traditional thought. Both of them challenged received wisdom. Just because it was handed down through the church, just because some famous person said it, just because it has prestigious authority behind it, doesn't make it so. In the matter of the Awakening, an evangelical revival, the center was individual experience. Conversion, salvation, call it what you want, is not a matter of simply memorizing a creed. It's not the acceptance of doctrine. It's not what the church says it is. It is a highly intensive personal experience. So experience is at the center of the Awakening. Experience is also the center of Enlightenment. The Enlightenment refused to say things are the way they are in the world. Things are the way they are in nature because that's the way God wanted them. Human society is the way it is because God wanted it that way. And if you think about what has happened in history using that logic, you know, women are inferior. That's the way God wanted it. Races are in an array of a hierarchy from inferior to superior. That's the way God wanted, or that's just the natural order. Very convenient argument. And Enlightenment thinkers said, no way. These aren't brought about by God, or they're not brought about as an essential part of nature. They developed out of history. Somebody enslaved people. Somebody said somebody else was the other. Somebody said that this was inferior or that was superior. And it might interest you to know, some of our founders, some of the most erudite founders engaged in that kind of pseudoscience. Thomas Jefferson, for example. Thomas Jefferson had a hierarchy of races. Guess who was at the top? You know, Caucasians. You know, they're at the top, boys. We got it. And then Native Americans, I think, were somewhere in the middle. He said that they had a funny smell, so surely that meant that they couldn't be superior. Africans, and this is brilliant, you know, most Africans were enslaved, had no rights, had no opportunity of education, so he relegated them to the bottom, as if that's just the way things are. So he made an essentialist argument when, in fact, it was a historical argument. Well, let's look a little closer at both the Great Awakening and the Enlightenment. The Great Awakening, as I said, was an evangelical revival with deep roots in Germany, central Germany. And people there, very close to where Martin Luther started the Reformation, at the end of the 17th century, were not very happy with how the Reformation had played out. So they wanted a deeper faith. And they wanted a more active faith. And so, in their minds, they wanted to take the Reformation to the next level. And so, they began in very small groups called Pietists. And they had a very deep faith. And it was not just a matter of having more prayer meetings or more worship services or what have you. Out of this small band of believers, they created the largest pharmacy in all of Europe. They were sending drugs around the world. They had the largest printing press, sending not just the Bible, but other materials all around the world. It was absolutely magnificent. Spread from there to England, Charles Wesley, John Wesley, deeply, deeply affected by the Awakening. One of Wesley's disciples, George Whitfield, came over to America as an itinerant preacher, and we had an American version of the Great Awakening. It was based on a simple message, a very simple message. In fact, Whitfield said, there is one thing needful. Forget about all of the doctrine, forget about all of the creeds, forget about all of that. The one thing needful is a spiritual new birth, a spiritual new birth. When he itinerated, when he went around from place to place, he did something else through the Awakening. He introduced religious choice in America. I mean, prior to the Great Awakening, if you wanted to worship on a Sunday, you went to the parish church. That was it. It was the only game in town. So you would go there. Now with the Awakening, in the churchyard would be an itinerant preacher. You could stop off and listen to him, or you could go into the church. And there are great accounts, I mean firsthand accounts of people doing just that. Some stayed under the tree and listened to the itinerant. Others went inside. So now we've got religious choice. Let me hasten to say the Great Awakening was not embraced by all Protestants in America. On one hand, the Great Awakening was unitive. It brought people together all over America. On the other hand, it divided Christians. There were plenty of people who thought that Whitfield and others were too censorious, too critical of other religious groups, and they also thought that they were filled with what they called enthusiasm. And enthusiasm was a heresy. Enthusiasm meant that you thought that you had direct contact with God. You're doing what you're doing, or you believe in what you believe because God gave you a special message. That's very unsettling to Orthodox ministers, obviously. God gave them the message. So the Great Awakening was a spiritual revival, and I would contend if you look at American history beginning with that revival, it's a history of revivals. I mean, America over and over, we have a second Great Awakening at the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century. Charles Grandison Finney in the 19th century, latter part of the 19th century, we got Billy Sunday. 20th century, most of us probably would know better Billy Graham, and unfortunately his son is continuing it. But there are plenty of examples throughout American history, this notion that religion must always be alive, awakened, fresh, that people need to be brought back to that individual experience. And I would contend, when foreigners say, we don't understand you people, you worship the almighty dollar, and yet you're so religious, part of it is religious because of all of the revival fervor. And also religious because of religious freedom. Americans don't have to toe the line. If they don't like an official church, which we don't have, they can go invent a new church. In fact, if you look at the fastest growing churches today, there aren't denominations, they're independent churches that people form. Well, at the same time that was going on, there was this thing called Enlightenment. And it's occurring about the same time in the 18th century. Interestingly enough, both of these movements had their origins in Europe. Now, we as Americans like to think that, we're exceptional and what have you. Well, maybe we are, but we got the basic building blocks from somewhere else. And there's nothing wrong with that. And the Enlightenment certainly was that. Let me give you a definition of Enlightenment. The one I like best is the one coming from, holy smokes, good grief. Let me give you very quickly, I have no idea, I'm sorry. Let me give you understanding from Immanuel Kant. Enlightenment is man's emergence from his self-imposed immaturity. Immaturity is the inability to use one's understanding without guidance from another. This immaturity is self-imposed when its cause lies not in lack of understanding, but in lack of resolve and courage to use it without guidance from another. And he ends up by saying, think for yourself. And to you students, if you don't learn anything else at Mercer, I hope you get the tools, I hope you get the confidence to think for yourself. Because I will assure you, there are all kinds of people waiting to tell you what to believe and to tell you what is truth and what have you, and you need to work that out. Let me close rather abruptly here by talking about how secular leaders and sacred leaders came together in the aftermath of the Awakening and the Enlightenment to fight for religious liberty. You know the story of the fight for religious liberty in Virginia, but I want to extract a piece or two of that. Patrick Henry, very passionate guy, moved in 1785 to alter the language that Thomas Jefferson had put in the Statute for Religious Freedom. Jefferson had put in his draft, he had made a reference to, quote, the holy author of our religion. And Patrick Henry said, no, we don't want that language. That's too enlightenment. That's too deistic. We want in the name of Jesus Christ, explicitly. He went on to say, who can argue with that? We are a Christian nation. Let's put Jesus Christ in this document on religious liberty. He thought that it was a good political move. He couldn't believe that anybody would object to it, but he underestimated James Madison, who was on his feet in a flash. No way, said Madison. No way. Now, he subscribed to Lockean liberalism, the centrality of the individual, and opposed any tyranny over the individual, including tyranny of the majority, including religious tyranny. And so he said, You know, you say Jesus Christ, you say Christian. Who's Christianity? Who defines it? By what authority? Is it the Bible? If so, what edition? What translation? Within the Bible, which books do you deem to be canonical? In which ones apocryphal? Outside of that, whose interpretation? Whose interpretation decides which of the sacred scriptures will prevail? Is it going to be the Trinitarians? Is it going to be the Unitarians? Is it going to be the New Lights, the Old Lights? Who is it going to be? Evangelicals or Episcopalians? And he said, God forbid, if Christians can't work out what Christianity means, then the government will decide. And here we have put government in the business of faith. That which should be secular is now defining that which would be sacred. I apologize to you. I got carried away. I used to be able to time these things down to the second. I'm getting old. I've lost a step. Let me close with this. I think we face issues today that would put Henry and Madison on exactly the same sides of the debate as they were in the past. We talked a bit this morning about prayer in school. A big issue. I'm sure that Henry would say, we got to have the kids praying in school and they need to pray out loud. We're a Christian nation and what have you. And I'm sure Madison would say, whose prayer? Who's going to write that prayer? You know, the fact of the matter is, as we said, students can, and I'm sure these up here before tests and what have you, do pray and pray without ceasing. Beth and I in our home, our first home in Louisville, had a very special closet. You know, Jesus said that when you pray, there shouldn't be a big public display. When you pray, you go in your closet and you pray to God. You know, this isn't about theater. This is about praying to God. And a fellow by the name of Gaines Dobbins, a professor at the seminary, built our house. And there's the story that he would come home from, it was across the street from the seminary, and he would come home after a hard day. Students had been unresponsive. That doesn't apply here, but faculty meeting had been tedious. It had just been a horrible day. He came in, barely accepted Mrs. Dobbins' peck on the cheek, and he said he walked upstairs. He went literally into the clothes closet of his bedroom. He closed the door and said, "Damn!" So, you know, maybe we all need that kind of thing. Well, now I close for sure. Thomas Jefferson was not present with Benjamin Franklin when he flew his kite, but Franklin's embrace of science certainly was something that Jefferson had a passion for. If you've ever been to Monticello, you know that Franklin was a scientist and a practical inventor at every point. But at the same time, Jefferson, like Franklin, was a champion of religious liberty, and religious liberty for everybody. What he said after the passage of the Virginia Act for religious freedom, he said, now everybody is under the mantle of the protection of this law, the Jew and the Gentile, the Christian and the Mohammedan, the Hindu, an infidel of every denomination. Tomorrow in chapel, we'll talk about how the separation of church and state is the vehicle to keep that kind of freedom in place. Thank you. I apologize for going so long.
That was Purdue Professor Frank Landberg discussing the secular and sacred alliance in the fight for religious liberty. It was the second of three presentations for the 2012 Walter B. and K.W. Sheridan Lectures on Religious Liberty and Separation of Church and State. For more on the Sheridan Lectures, visit our website at bjconline.org/lectures.